This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
And good morning and welcome to Guardian AM here on Guardian 9FM. And of course, Guardian AM is with C.A. Nuri normally. Today, however, Dr. Cleveland W. Enius III, also known as Kahun Ankusara, will be taking the wheel today. And so we have another great show for those of you listening today. Before we dive into today's show, of course, we want to keep the family of the young girl that was found yesterday brutally murdered. Want to keep them in prayers and want to keep the entire nation in prayers as we all mourn this tragic event. I won't speak too much on it today, but I definitely want everybody to know that it's at the front of everybody's mind. So we want to definitely keep everybody in prayer. All right. Today's show, we have another wonderful guest via Zoom today, and I'm going to introduce him in just a second. But today's show is centered around an icon in not only the Bahamas, but the Caribbean, the United States, Europe, Africa, around the world, the Honorable Garvey. And we are talking about this period of time here in November where Marcus Garvey, he visited the Bahamas at one time. I don't think many people talk about it. We don't talk about it that much as we may have done in the past, but I'm sure there are people who obviously know this, but there may be a lot of people who don't know it. And so we're going to have that conversation in just a second. Before we dive into it, though, I just want to make it make you all aware that the Holy Coptic Church has a men's conference. It's free. This December 20th and 21st, the Courage of Scriptural Masculinity. The Courage of Scriptural Masculinity. You can go to journeyhomegroup.com. With everything going on in the country that has been going on, these types of conversations help us to get to the crux of the matter. So definitely go on to journeyhomegroup.com. The Courage of Scriptural Masculinity, a men's conference, December 20th and 21st of this year. Without further ado, however, introduce our guests for today. All the way from Jamaica. Stephen Golden is the president of the UNIA in Jamaica. We talked about the UNIA if not, I think it was last week. But we're going to dive into the UNIA, the organization started by the Honorable Marcus Garvey, Amy Jacques Garvey, and others. And so we're going to talk about this reality of Marcus Garvey having come to the Bahamas. Another topics surrounding this reality. But Brother Stephen, can you hear us?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Excellent.
Good to be here.
Yes.
Morning to your listeners. Thanks for having me on the program. Greetings, Bahamas.
Yes, Brother Golden. Listen, it's a pleasure to have you here. And I know you had to take time out of your busy schedule to be here. So we are grateful to have you here. Before we dive into today's topic, just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself so they have an idea, an understanding of who you are and what you mean to the UNIA in Jamaica.
Well, as you said, I am the president of the Universal Negro Improvement Association in Jamaica, which was the first division founded by Marcus Garvey. Of course, in Jamaica, we title him the Right Excellent Marcus Mosiah Garvey because yes, he has been our first national hero since 1964.
Amen.
But I'm also a professor of Garveyism, and I specialize in teaching teachers.
Wow.
Because a number of years, the Jamaican Political Bureau has been bantering about, you know, teaching Garveyism in our schools and why we're not doing it. So I answered the call, understanding that teachers cannot teach something they themselves haven't been taught.
Correct.
And so we've spent a number of years in the teacher training institutions, as well as in the schools, because we had to pilot programs. It's not enough to just teach from a theoretical point of view, but, you know, being in the classroom is like, you know, being in the battlefield. So you have to know certain things that work on paper don't work in the field.
Yeah.
And so we've done it at the early childhood level, the primary school level, the high school level. For 5 years, we even taught Garveyism in the correctional institutions, General Penitentiary here.
Awful.
It is a excellent tool, social engineering.
Yes.
And social engineering is how we heal a lot of the issues of our society, like crime and other things. And I'm so sorry to hear the news of what happened in Bahamas. I caught a little of it while I was in the waiting room.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, sending out our condolences and our prayers to the family.
Mm-hmm.
It's so sad that as a people descendant from Africans who were trafficked and who were brutalized in chattel slavery, that we continue to inflict some of these injustices upon ourselves. This is also something that I believe that by educating people in the philosophies of Garveyism can help eradicate out of our society.
Oh, definitely. I can tell this is just part one of many parts, because I know we're not going to get through everything today. But Brother Stephen, Marcus Garvey, the giant that he was, not only in Jamaica, but globally amongst African people, he came to the Bahamas and I want to read a little excerpt from a book that you may or may not be familiar with. It's The Faith That Moved the Mountain. This is a memoir of the life and times of Fawkes. I think it's a great read that we can get you a copy of at some point. But
yes,
he talks about this reality of Garvey very briefly in his book. And I want to share it with you so you have a little understanding of what we are seeing on this side of Garveyism here in the Bahamas, right? For those who may have the book, this is on page four. So at the beginning of the book, it's making reference to Garvey. And they're talking about a politician by the name of Leon Walton Young. And the reason why they're mentioning Garvey, they say because in November of 1928, when Marcus Garvey was denied entrance into the Bahamas by the white minority government, it was cousin Leon who successfully intervened on his behalf and assisted him in launching his Back to Africa movement at a mass rally on the Southern Recreation Grounds. Doesn't go into too much about what happened at that particular rally, but I remember reading this book and I was excited to see that we had some documentation of Garvey being here. And so I'm very excited to see what you're going to add to that excerpt of the book. But he would have been coming here at a time where we did have this white minority government, and but he was allowed to come in eventually with the help of Leon Walton Young, L.W. Young, which we have a school named after here in Bahamas. Kind of guide us on what it is that we should know here in Bahamas from the perspective of Garveyism and him coming here in 1928.
Well, let me preface that first.
Sure.
By saying that, you know, Marcus Garvey, and many people know the story, was, you know, sent to prison on trumped up charges of mail fraud,
mm-hmm.
Sentenced to 5 years, but had his sentence commuted by President Calvin Coolidge,
mm-hmm.
in 1927, with the caveat that he was to be immediately deported.
Mm.
A lot of this had to do with the fact that in 1921, when they tried to deny Garvey a visa to return to the United States after he had done his Caribbean tour with the Black Star Line. Mm-hmm. He had immediately applied for citizenship. And so the Bureau of Investigation at the time was sort of in a race to charge him so that they could deport him before he was granted that citizenship. Mm. Anyway, he's pardoned by Coolidge, but deported in December 2nd, 1927, and arrives in Jamaica on December 10th. Now, the following year, Garvey didn't spend a lot of time in Jamaica. He immediately went back to work, and he left the island, going first to the UK, where he gave his first public lecture at Royal Albert Hall on June 6th. Then he went on to present a petition on behalf of Africans and African descendants around the world to the League of Nations in Geneva in September of 1928, before returning to the UK and then heading to Canada. Now, he went to Canada so that he could have a convention and allow for, the members from his many North American divisions, particularly in the United States, which he was now not allowed to reenter, that they would be able to come across the border and meet with him in Canada. So this is when the colonial authorities or the British influence over these authorities came into play. And in Canada, he was told by the Royal Mounties that he was not going to be allowed to hold any public lectures. They couldn't stop him from entering the country because he was a British citizen at that time, being a Jamaican. But he was not allowed to hold any public meetings or political rallies. Now, what he did was instead of, the big lecture halls, he would have small meetings in the homes of UNIA members and UNIA officers. Mm. By the time he left Canada now, he traveled back to Jamaica via first Bermuda and then the Bahamas. Mm. In Bermuda, again, the British colonial authorities this time now told him that he was not even allowed to enter the country, that he would not be allowed to disembark from the ship. Because, I guess there had been communication from Canada. They were now wise to the fact that, Garvey was cleverly moving around the obstacles and being able to meet with his members and the followers of in the UNI. Concern to the colonial governments at the time. Mm-hmm. It was the effect that Garvey had on the black masses, particularly how it affected them as a labor force. And his agitation for Africa, which had been gobbled up by most of the European powers at that time. Even America was active in the Republic of Liberia. Mm-hmm. So we saw a trend. They didn't interfere with him in Europe or the UK, but by the time he gets to Canada now, it's the attitude is he must not be allowed to speak. Mm. He goes to Bermuda on November 15th. He's not allowed to disembark the ship. He then leaves Bermuda and arrives in the Bahamas, I believe, on November 19th, where he is scheduled to speak. But he's told the same thing by the Bahamian colonial authorities, though they did not prevent him from disembarking the ship. And so Garvey was, left with the same options he had in Canada to have, smaller meetings, no big public lectures, but smaller meetings at the home of some of the Garveyites. And I suspect the gentleman you mentioned would have been one of those persons who hosted him and allowed him to meet with the Garveyites.
Sir Randall Fox, yes. Milton Young.
Yes, yes. But, people have to understand that Marcus Garvey was a giant of a man in what he accomplished, but he did not accomplish those things alone.
No.
In fact, there were a number of Garveyite leaders within the movement who did most of the heavy lifting. And the Bahamas is not to be excluded from that. They're very key members of the UNIA, who hail from the Bahamas. least amongst them, the first captain of the Black Star line, Joshua Cockburn, who I understand when Garvey did have those meetings in Bahamas, he had some choice words for him. Of course, they had fallen out by that time.
I heard about that. Mm-hmm.
The Bahamians didn't take lightly to an attack on one of their own. Mm. But there is also an unsung hero in Bahamas by the name of Reverend Higgs. Mm. I believe he's the founder of one of your AME churches there, perhaps St. Paul or another. Mm. But Reverend Higgs is such a pivotal figure in the Garvey movement and so unknown in terms of the ramifications of what happened with him. Reverend Higgs was the first president of the UNIA division that was involved in Miami. Mm. Of course, this is a place they used to refer to as Little Bahamas. Mm-hmm. And that division was founded by Garvey in 1921 as he was leaving the United States to go on that tour of the Caribbean for the Black Star Line, that same tour that J. Edgar Hoover tried to use the opportunity to keep him out of the country, but mm-hmm. failed. Mm-hmm. Now, while Garvey was away, the Ku Klux Klan in Florida reacted aggressively to the fact that Garvey had formed two divisions there, one in Coconut Grove in Miami and the other in Key West. Mm. And they themselves organized branches in response to the UNIA's activities in those cities. And in fact, went as far as to kidnap one of the UNIA presidents. This is the one from Key West, as well as Reverend Higgs, wow. a Bahamian who led the division in Coconut Grove. Mm. Now, people have to understand that Garvey's UNIA was a very militant organization. Mm. We were not a civil rights protesting organization who only marched and placarded whenever there were issues. Mm. In fact, there was a paramilitary auxiliary attached to the UNIA, Universal African Legions. Mm-hmm. And it consisted of Black men returning from World War I, some of them even former members of the British West Indies Regiment, some of them, part of the U.S. military, because, of course, the UNIA had divisions throughout the region, both in North, Central, and South America, and a number of divisions across the Caribbean islands. Mm-hmm. So when these presidents were kidnapped, members of the legions armed themselves and took to the streets, sending a message to the KKK that if they were to find any of these presidents hanging somewhere, or if they failed to return within 24 hours, then it was going to be a life for life, bullet for bullet. Mm. Basically, they were threatening war. Mm. And would you know it, that the KKK returned both presidents. But of course, by this time, Garvey had realized that there was a move afoot politically to keep him out of the country. Mm. So having gone through the ordeal of having to contact the Secretary of State to get his visa issued in Panama, because they wouldn't even issue it to him in Jamaica, which is where he should have gotten it, being a Jamaican, he re-enters the country and he makes a recording explaining the aims and objectives of the UNIA to sort of let the U.S. government see him in a less threatening light. Mm. The following year in 1922, he called a meeting with the head of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. Now, this was something that, you know, African-American leaders chastised him for, mm-hmm. and even went as far as calling him a Black Klansman. Hmm. But they were unaware of the fact that UNIA divisions, particularly in Florida, had been in gun battles with the Ku Klux Klan. So Garvey called this meeting not as a beggar or not to give any recognition to the racist agenda of the KKK, but as a general of his own armies who were now engaged in conflict, and it was a conflict that he wanted quashed, given the fact that he was coming under immense pressure from the U.S. government. Mm. And so he actually, arranged for Reverend Higgs to come to New York before he returned to Bahamas, because, you know, being a person who had been targeted by the KKK, Garvey felt it was best to get him out of the city in order to get the tensions down, so that some sort of ceasefire could be negotiated. You know, these stories are not written, but you know, if people Google Reverend Higgs Bahamas KKK, I believe they will find an article in the Miami Herald that speaks about a reunion of the Higgs family at the church that he built in Miami, which highlighted the circumstances under which he had to leave Florida, which is very much connected to and the story that I just told you all. So I want the people in the Bahamas to know just how important many of their citizens were in the Garvey movement and to Marcus Garvey himself. You know, this is the reason why to date he has formed the largest mass organization of Black people ever seen on earth. And it was led primarily by quote unquote West Indian Negroes, as they were called in that day, but African descendants from the Caribbean, and not just Jamaica, but all throughout the Caribbean region and in every single one of what we call today the CARICOM countries.
Yes, yes, man. This is such a wonderful experience we're having here on Guardian AM with C.A. Nuri. My name is Dr. Cleveland W. Enius III, and we're listening to the voice of Brother Stephen Golding all the way from Jamaica. He's the president of the UNIA in Jamaica, and he's really given us a beautiful history lesson on Garveyism in the Bahamas, and the fact that there's a... So you've formulated a curriculum, I'm correct, in saying, in Jamaica?
Yes, man. We have a curriculum both at the early childhood and primary level, which starts with what we call the Garvey ABCs, going right up to high school and then into the teacher training institutions where we teach Garveyism on a three-point platform, African fundamentalism, African nationalism, and African redemption, which is a phrase that Garvey coined himself, you know? One of the things people have to understand is that when we talk about teaching Garveyism, we're not a biography of Marcus Garvey. Those things are for a history class. We are talking about what Garvey described as a racial and cultural education designed for the uplift and benefit of our people in particular. Because we have a particular history that we share across the islands and even into North America. And therefore, the way we approach social engineering and the creation of our own society, with education being one of the cornerstones of how societies are constructed, has to speak to that particular history. And it has to build our collective unity, strength, and security going forward as an answer to some of the obstacles that we have faced in the past and continue to face even now in the 21st century. I mean, look what we saw with the martyrdom of George Floyd.
Yeah.
And how quickly Garvey's flag began to fly across the screen in response to that. People were seeing the red, black, and green everywhere.
Yes, yes. And so, you know, that I'm happy you put it that way in terms of social engineering. How do you quantify the impact of Garveyism in Jamaica and be taught in the world? I don't know if it's only in Jamaica, but how do you quantify the impact of the social engineering, or is that something that you focus on at all?
No, we do focus on it. You know, first of all, I run into students from my pilot programs, which I did for 10 years all the time. They're now in university. They've now graduated. I mean, I was in the airport the other day running late for my flight, and they opened the door back for me simply because the lady at the gate had been one of my students. And the last thing I said to her was, "You still remember your ABCs?" And she said, "Yes, sir."
Powerful.
But no, listen, in Jamaica, and I'm sure it's no different in Bahamas. I mean, we even have to still be dealing with issues that were contemporary to Garvey's time, such as skin bleaching, right?
Yeah.
The issue of black-on-black violence. Because I'm sure, as it is in Jamaica, it is in Bahamas. Most of the times you hear about crimes, and particularly violent crimes between people.
Yeah.
It is never between the black Bahamians and the white Bahamians, or even the white tourists.
No.
But it is always between the black Jamaicans here.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes to show that having been the subject of probably the most diabolical social experiment ever carried.
Mm-hmm.
And for 300 years.
Yeah.
I'm not even talking about 10 years like the Jewish Holocaust was, mm-hmm. that the world seems with the world will never forget.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Holocaust that went on 30 times as long.
Yes.
For over 3 centuries.
Yes.
It was illegal to educate Africans during the period of trafficking and enslavement, mm-hmm. In the Americas. Mm-hmm. And even after emancipation, it took a number of years before we were even recognized as being fully human.
Mm-hmm.
At one point in the United States, they were considered 2/3 or 3/5 of a human being.
Mm.
We in the Caribbean weren't even recognized as citizens until the mid-20th century, when we were given the right to maybe even, you know, vote in our own national elections. You all remember this.
Mm-hmm.
So we cannot ignore the fact that having a society that has been subjected to those kind, you know, the signing of adult suffrage or the raising of a national flag is not going to change that society,
right.
Immediately or overnight.
Right.
So we have to be honest in terms of what we see happening today and connecting it to those fabric of the past, which is the reason why our people still see value in bleaching their skin.
Yeah.
It's the reason why our people are still quick to visit violence on others who look like themselves. This is why Marcus Garvey called his program African Redemption, you know.
Yes.
Because the word redemption means to redeem. Redeem means to restore value to.
Mm-hmm.
And so within our own minds as a people, because we were devalued by the system of oppression, we internalized that and not only devalued ourselves, but began to devalue our brothers and sisters around us who looked like us. And that is why our societies suffer from some of these social ills and social problems, hurting the babies, murdering the children. This is not normal behavior.
No.
This is not the way we behaved in Africa before Europe came,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Garveyism, when he says a racial and cultural education, means that from the very early part of their education, we have to reinforce in them a sense of identity, a sense of fraternity and brotherhood, a sense of purpose, a mission of the struggles of our ancestors, and the realization of the hopes that they had, because they were the ones who began the fight against the oppression, both physically, socially, economically, and other things. The A in our Garvey ABCs teaches children Africa for the Africans at home and abroad. But the root of it is grounded in recognizing themselves, recognizing their ancient ancestry, and being proud of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So when we teach mathematics, we can insert Garveyism into it by telling people the truth that Pythagoras did not discover a theorem, because the first man to build the pyramids was a man named Imhotep.
Yes.
So when you teach the children about Imhotep, who looked like them,
mm-hmm.
rather than beat it into their heads, the story of Pythagoras, who was a fraud, it begins to show them the contributions that Africa and their ancestors made to civilization. And it counteracts the history that teaches them that they're the descendants of slaves.
Yes.
Nobody is the descendants of slaves. We're all the descendants of human beings.
Mm.
Britain was enslaved by the Romans, but never in their classrooms or in their descendants of slaves, even though their ancestors were enslaved just as ours.
Yes, so, indeed. Yes, indeed.
This is Garveyism.
Yeah.
This is how we teach it. We can go an hour without even mentioning what Marcus Garvey did in his life. We just
I'm telling you.
Because he was the man in the 20th century who began to bring these things to light, when he began to talk about Timbuktu, when he began to talk about ancient Ethiopia and Egypt, you know, coming out of slavery and civil war, those things had been forgotten.
Yes.
And Garvey helped us to reclaim it.
Brother Golden, we got a call on the line. I think two callers. Callers, you are on Guardian AM with Brother Stephen Golden all the way from Jamaica, the president of UNIA. Good morning.
Yeah, UNIA. Yes. Self-Reliance for Black People Today. Yeah, I read the book. I have the outlook. I appreciate the brother in his chronology, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we know that wherever Marcus went, they hated him, they berated him, and they never liberated him.
Mm.
All right? Now, Marcus Garvey, I sent you a photograph of what I have up in my shop, right?
Yeah, I saw it.
And I would like for you to read it when I'm finished. But the thing is, I appreciate the brother in keeping up the UNIA. But you remember, he was targeted by the FBI also in the form of J. Edgar Hoover and personal attacks also.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that he met Dr. Robert Love. But the thing is, what is so amazing, when he became so nervous, he actually was embarrassed and he fell down on the stage, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I like how he brought in the intricacies of the meeting with the Ku Klux Klan. So
yeah.
Now we remember that Marcus Garvey's father was a friend of, I think Malcolm X's father was a great friend of Marcus Garvey, right?
He was UNIA president in Omaha. You're very right.
So, but what I'm saying is, brother, you have a lot of gonads for upkeeping this when we have seen the trend. So wherever Marcus went, when he went to Panama also, they deported him because he was brought there because of the working conditions during the Panama Canal, et cetera, et cetera. So
do you have any questions for Brother Golden?
But what I really wanted to chime in
was
I wanted you to play a song that relates to him. Most of us wouldn't remember the old Burning Spear. And so there's a contemporary song by Muda Baruka, and there's one by Black Uhura. One was they didn't have a public holiday for Marcus Garvey, and there's a song that Muda Baruka sing in the form of a poetry. It's a girl, similar to this, Marcus Garvey rising from earth, like Moses picked from birth.
Mm.
Come children, say it loud. That means they were still black and proud.
Mm.
So just play one of those to inspire us. Let it be. They didn't
I'll
have a public holiday.
I'll see if the producer can help us out.
Which is very, very entertaining. So do that for me, Anko, please.
Appreciate
one of
you, call.
Or yeah. No One Remember Old Marcus by Burning Spear.
Yes. Producer, maybe you could help us out. Thank you so much, 52, for calling.
And I want the brother to know that we have artists still making music about Marcus Garvey.
Of course.
So, as much as we know, them foundation man that were the ones who kept him in the world, forcibly try to forget him or make us forget him. They've inspired a whole generation. And I also want to salute the brother for mentioning Dr. Joseph Robert Love, who is a great Bahamian, the first man to graduate from medical school at the University of Buffalo, you know, served as the chief medical officer in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, before coming to Jamaica and being one of the first black members of parliament or members of the House of Representatives. He certainly was a mentor to Marcus Garvey. In fact, Marcus Garvey eulogized him in November of 1914. And in fact, today, November 21st, is the anniversary of the passing of Dr. Love in Jamaica in 1914.
Wow! What a blessed day, and a blessed moment to remember everything that has gone on that some of us, many of us, have forgotten, and now we are being remembering it or learning about it for the first time. We got another caller on the line. Caller, you're on Guardian AM with CA Nuri. Good morning. Is the caller there? All right, caller, just try to call back. 323-6232-325-4316. 325-4. And, of course, our toll-free lines for the family of islands, 242-300-5720. Of course, our text line powered by BTC is 422-4796. We are on with Stephen Golden, the president of the UNIA in Jamaica. I think the caller may have called back, or we may have another caller. Let's just patch it through. Sure. Caller, welcome to Guardian AM with CA Nuri.
Good afternoon, my brother. Good afternoon to the guest.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I have a question for the guest. Ghana in Africa, I would like for him to explain what role did Ghana play in the making of slavery? And what role is Ghana still playing? Because I think back in the early 1600s or before, I think what happened with the black and the white, I think we have been labeled as the, in terms of who should be in different category. So I think Ghana played a major role back in the day in terms of the manufacturing of slavery. And I'll hang up and listen to hear what you have to say.
Okay, thank you for the question, Brother Golan.
Let me start off by saying, you know, the old narrative that we get from the colonial curriculum was that Africans sold each other into slavery.
Yeah.
But they do not put it in the context of, and has been a part of every civilization and every society.
Mm-hmm.
In Africa, slavery was a part of our penal policy, right? And when I say penal, nowadays when somebody commits a crime, we build a place and we put them in prison for how many years, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was not the way that Africa functioned.
Mm-hmm.
The way to deal with criminals and the way to deal with prisoners of wars, as kingdoms fought with other kingdoms to expand into empires. Sometimes after an empire, a kingdom is conquered, you cannot assimilate or absorb those soldiers back into the society. They're going to constantly be working to undermine and mm-hmm. reclaim a victory out of a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is how slavery was in Africa. It was a means of you know, removing criminals from society because we did not build places to lock them up.
Mm-hmm.
We did not think in the terms of Europeans. It was a way to get them away from that society. They were sold to another tribe, and after serving a certain period, you know, serving out their sentence, so to speak, they were absorbed into that tribe as a member.
Mm-hmm.
Another key thing to note is that if they had children during the period of their enslavement, slavery, neither would they be bred by their quote-unquote slave masters who would then enslave their own children.
Mm.
So this banter that Africans sold Africans into slavery does not quantify the fact that Africans had no concept of chattel slavery.
Mm.
Every society has had slavery in it. Chattel slavery, though, is a creation of the Europeans.
Mm.
Right? We continue to talk about the transatlantic slave trade, but really it should be called the European, quote-unquote, slave trade.
Yes.
And the invention of chattel slavery, which is what white supremacy and racism grew out of, was a completely different creature. And I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
One of Jamaica's folk heroes is a man known as Chief Tachi, who came from Ghana. As the brother is asking about Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Tachi was a slave trader in Ghana,
mm-hmm.
but he got tricked and put on a slave ship himself and ended up enslaved in Jamaica. When he got here was his first experience with chattel slavery. This is a man who had dealt in slavery as an industry in Africa.
Mm.
He was so appalled with what he saw that he ended up leading the largest led the largest war battle against chattel enslavement of Africans here in Jamaica in 1760. In fact, their theory is that some of those who fought in that battle fled the island and ended up in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And 20, 30 years later were a part of the Great Haitian Revolution, which was by far the most successful war against chattel slavery during that period.
Mm.
Another thing I want my friends in Bahamas to understand is we have to understand that a lot of our story has been hidden from us, has been covered up, or has been transformed into something that is so far from the truth of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only way a minority European population could enslave a majority African population is to do as Steve Biko said, that the greatest weapon in the hands of the oppressor is always the minds of the oppressed. Not the weapons that they carry,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but the control they have on our minds.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Bahamas once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
You guys eat a lot of conch over there. I love it too. But one thing I notice is your preservation and Junkanoo culture, which, you know, exists in many islands, even here in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few months ago, I gave a lecture asking teachers here in Jamaica if they had any idea about the true history of John Canoe. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm on the airwaves in Bahamas, I want to take the opportunity
Please.
To ask that same question to the Bahamian people. We look at John Canoe in Jamaica as something that happens around Christmas time, and it's seen as like a carnival dress-up thing. But do we know that John Canoe, otherwise known as January Canoe, was actually a Ghanaian chief or king?
Yes, definitely, yes.
Who led an attack on a slave fort in Ghana. He was a Ahante chief. He led an attack on a slave fort that was held by the Prussians at the time, and they decided to hand it over to the Dutch without consulting with the chiefs who were responsible for the lands in Ghana. And John Canoe took offense to this and led an attack. And of course, he chose Christmas time to lead that attack because being quote unquote Christians, these Europeans had certain times of the year where they would celebrate and have festivities and get drunk. And if you observed them and knew the calendar, it was the right time to catch them when they were weak. It is the same way that a number of quote unquote slave rebellions occurred in the Bahamas, in Jamaica, in Barbados, other parts of the Caribbean and the United States. Our ancestors always chose those particular times to strike because they were dealing with people who had more weapons and were more organized for war than they were. And so they had to use intelligence to strategize when would be the best time to fight for their freedom. I am just surprised that the John Canoe has become such a cultural activity in our in our region. Yet the true story of the Ahante chief known as January Canoe, who is where the word John Canoe comes from, or which becomes John Canoe, is completely lost, and we don't even teach that to our children.
Yeah,
we teach about John Canoe being a dance and celebration thing. No, John Canoe was a first attack against European chattel slavery in the heart of Africa where it was happening.
Yeah,
and some of his followers who were brought over to the Caribbean remembered him and remembered his Christmas attack. And this is how John Canoe becomes a phenomenon of dressing up and celebrating at Christmas time. I'm dropping some history on you today.
I appreciate it. And let me just say, we have some brothers and sisters here who are making pilgrimages now to Ghana to actually reclaim that story. Who's been named John Canoe II. The Queen Mother, Angelique McKay, they are doing a wonderful job with helping us to do exactly what you're doing today, which is re-educating the populace on exactly
where...
Yes,
sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
I met that brother, Christopher. He was here for a John Canoe thing in Jamaica a few months ago. And we had this conversation, and I'm so happy to hear you say that he's bringing that education along.
Definitely.
Wonderful work, my brothers.
Yeah. Do we have to take a break, producer? I know we're coming in at a couple more minutes, but... You just run through it? All right, beautiful. Listen, man, we got about maybe 5 more minutes left in the show. I was happy to hear you because I was going to ask you about Dr. Robert Love and how much of a role how much he comes up in the curriculum with regard to his influence on a Marcus Garvey, because we hear in the Bahamas, hear about Dr. Robert Love and... you know, obviously it is a part of the curriculum, but this idea that, you know, Garveyism was something in the past, right? The Garveyism is something that happened and it is not still happening. I think for me, I'm excited to hear that there is a curriculum. I think we need to find a way to bring the curriculum here to the Bahamas or elements of that curriculum to the Bahamas, because I feel as if you know, Marcus Garvey, within the Holy Coptic Church of the Black Messiah, where I'm a pastor and a Calhoun, we recognize Marcus Garvey as a part of this Christ consciousness or this Christ consciousness. Where in the book of Job, chapter 19, verse 25, it says, "For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth." And we see Marcus Garvey and all of those who stood with Marcus Garvey as a part of this redemption force.
Well, you know, You're not too far away from even the Bobo Ashanti, who recognize him as part of their trinity, you know, being mm-hmm. the prophet.
Mm-hmm.
Even in Garvey's day, you know, while he was living, he was referred to as the Black Moses.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad you bring up the idea of bringing the curriculum to the Bahamas, because mm-hmm. one of the things we've been doing this year is establishing annual symposiums in various countries on the dates that Marcus Garvey visited them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have put a proposal forward to do one in the Bahamas come next year, November 19th and 20th or 21, so that we can not only recognize Garvey and his visit there, recognize Dr. Love and his passing and his influence on Marcus Garvey, but have an annual session
mm-hmm.
where we bring either the teachers and the educators mm-hmm. to talk about how we do this and grow from there each year from strength to strength. Mm-hmm. We can engage with the security forces because they need to learn Garveyism in terms of how to deal with ourselves as a people.
Mm-hmm.
Even the politicians and mm-hmm. and the ministers need mm-hmm. a little of this. The doctors.
And the churches.
So that is the idea behind having it annually mm-hmm. as opposed to having a one-off event. So everyone who is listening and everyone who can appreciate what we're talking about, I'm asking you all to support this. You know, we have a sister over there, Jennifer, you know her.
Yes.
Brother. We're working with your church. We want to work with Reverend Higgs Church.
Mm-hmm.
We want to work with the schools. We want to work with the University of Bahamas, where I gave a lecture, I think almost 8 or 9 years ago now, to implement this thing as an annual thing. And in fact, this year we did it in Barbados, Trinidad, St. Vincent and St. Lucia. We did it in Bermuda last week. It was an overwhelming success because we kept emphasizing that when Garvey came, they wouldn't let him speak. And so now, you know, we are spreading the realm to let him know that he's arrived and he has landed, and we're going to do it every year in honor of him. I would love to see that in Bahamas, but we need the support,
mm-hmm.
Both from private and public sector. We have a number of months to plan it, and we would even like to bring next year the first narrative film on Marcus Garvey for a screening, its premiere in the Bahamas.
Wow.
So everyone listening, they can get in touch with you. You know how to find me and others who've been working behind the scene on this project. Let's get it done. Let's put it together.
We're going to make it happen, my brother. I appreciate you making the time for us today. Listen, this has definitely been a true blessing, whereby, you know, we hear so many stories. I know the Rastafarian community, growing up, I always heard that they would mention, they said that Marcus Garvey, when he was here, said that the Bahamas would be the last to know, but the first to do something about our liberation. You know, it's a tale that's been told. I don't know how that fits into the curriculum, but it's definitely, for me, inspiration with regard to Marcus Garvey moving even in this day and time. So I appreciate you taking your time, and we're going to definitely be in touch so that next year this time we're not speaking via Zoom, but we'll be speaking face-to-face.
Live from the symposium, maybe.
Yes, indeed.
And I want to ask your listeners, it's a good way for us to get feedback and to know, you know who's tuning in and whether we're resonating. If they're on social media, please follow us at UNIA Jamaica on Instagram. Follow us, send us a message. We're at UNIA Jamaica on all social media platforms, Facebook too. But we love to see, after doing a show like this, the responses coming in from Instagram. It lets us know the people are listening.
Yes.
It lets us know that they're feeling the energy, and it helps us to build momentum towards bringing the annual symposium to the Commonwealth of the Bahamas come 2025.
Amen, amen. The voice of Stephen Golden, president of the UNIA in Jamaica. This has been Guardian AM with C.A. Nuri. My name is Dr. Cleveland W. Ennius III, also known as Kahun Anku Sara. We leave you today with music from, who the song is from producer? This Burning Spear. Yes, indeed. We say namaste, we bow to the divinity within you. And have a wonderful day. Howard Grant is up next here on 96.9 Guardian Radio. Keep it locked.
I tell you, to write, to write, to write, to write, to write. To write, to write, to write, to write, to write, to write. I beg you, oh, tell you to do right.